Recorded Books and RB Digital present Engineering Infinity. Edited by Jonathan Strawn. Narrated by Christopher Ashman, Christopher Curry, Amin El Gamal, Emily Lawrence, Brian Nishi, Elam Orion, Inger Tudor, and Michael Welsh.
Engineering Infinity. Introduction. Beyond the Gernsback Continuum. Jonathan Strawn. I was in a bar. I think it was in Calgary in Canada. And it was the middle of winter. Or it might have been the bar in Denver in the United States. A little earlier in the same winter. Wherever it was. It was the winter of 2008 somewhere in North America, and George Mann and the Solaris team had asked me to join them for a drink. I don't drink often and I don't drink heavily, but I do drink at science fiction conventions, especially when a publisher has invited me to join him. It seemed that Solaris would like me to edit an anthology for them, a hard science fiction anthology, or something similar. The book that has become the one you now hold in your hands. Engineering Infinity. I was flattered, delighted in fact, and given that I had some experience editing such stuff, I agreed readily to the idea. At the time, and in the several months following that trip to Canada, it was Canada, I'm sure, we went back and forth a little about titles and about what writers might be involved. But oddly, in retrospect, what we didn't discuss was what hard science fiction was, or what it might be in the 21st century. The reason for that, I think, is what I now think of as the Gernsback Continuum. Science fiction readers love taxonomy, classifying, arranging, and defining things. And what we love to taxonomize the most is science fiction itself. The Gernsback Continuum is the slice of science fiction history that starts with Hugo Gernsback's Amazing Stories, progresses to John W. Campbell's Astounding Magazine, and the big three of science fiction, Robert Heinlein, Isaac Asimov, and Arthur C. Clarke, and then on to the New Wave and its descendants. It's a mostly male worldview, a mostly white one, and it holds at its heart hard SF. The term hard SF, or hard science fiction, was first coined in 1957 by P. Schuyler Miller to describe science fiction stories that emphasize scientific detail or technical detail, and where the story itself turns on a point of scientific accuracy from the fields of physics, chemistry, biology or astronomy. Although engineering stories were also commonly described as hard science fiction in the early days of SF, the great early works of hard science fiction, James Blish's Surface Tension, Hal Clement's Mission of Gravity, Tom Godwin's The Cold Equations, and Arthur C. Clarke's A Fall of Moondust, are some of the best and most enduring works of science fiction our field has seen. They all exemplify the hard SF approach, emphasizing science content, linking it directly to the narrative, and maintaining a rigorous approach to the science itself. They also meet the most important requirement for the true hard SF story. They all are as accurate and rigorous in their use of scientific knowledge at the time of writing as was possible. Hard science fiction has remained a constant throughout the history of science fiction. In the 1950s, it was where the best tales of space exploration were forged. In the 1960s, it was the heart of near-Earth science fiction. In the 1980s, it was the radical center for the British drive to the new space opera. And in the 1990s, with the arrival of both quantum mechanics in science fiction and the singularity, It was the basis for Kim Stanley Robinson's meticulous and demanding Mars trilogy. Greg Egan's explorations of human consciousness and Charles Stross's post-scarcity space operas. This, however, is the 21st century, and I think things are becoming more complicated and complex. Science fiction no longer subscribes readily to a single view of its own history. There's far more to our past than the Gernsback continuum, or indeed more recently the Gibson continuum. The past and future history of cyberpunk and science itself seems to be an ever more wriggly and complex beast as we come to better understand the universe in which we find ourselves. Frankly, quantum mechanics often sounds indistinguishable from magic. We're also well into the fourth generation of science fiction. The genre has been born, passed through adolescence into adulthood, and is moving into a post-scarcity period of incredible richness and diversity. That impacts on everything in our field, from the diversity of the people who write science fiction to whom and about what they choose to write. We've also long since accepted that science fiction writers aren't backroom Nostradamuses reading tea leaves and predicting the future. They're people using science fiction as a tool to interrogate and extrapolate from our present for what we can learn about the human condition. All of this became increasingly clear to me as Engineering Infinity came together. Slowly drift set in. We moved away from pure, hard SF to something a little broader. Yes, each and every story here has at its heart a piece of scientific speculation. Yes, there's a real attempt not to break any known laws of physics. But far more importantly, I think, the writers here who are some of our finest dreamers turned away from Tom Godwin's The Cold Equations and towards the promise embedded in the title of this book itself. The point where the practical application of science meets something without bound or end. Our sense of wonder. There'll be times as you read the stories collected here, encountering everything from a mirror that makes us ask who is real and who is not, to a cannibalistic zombie cyborg. Where, you might ask, how is this story hard SF? My answer, the best answer I can give you, is that some of the stories are classic hard SF. Some are not. Some hold at their heart a slightly anachronistic love of science fiction's days gone by, or simply grab some aspect of science fiction and test it to destruction and beyond. But all are striving to be great stories. I should add, Engineering Infinity is not the last statement in an evolutionary taxonomy of hard SF. For all that, I'd love to see such a book. It's neither a definitive book of hard SF, nor an attempt to coin a new radical hard SF. Instead, it is part of the ongoing discussion about what science fiction is in the 21st century. I hope you enjoy it as much as I have enjoyed compiling it. And that may be just perhaps it inspires you to look forward at what's coming next. Jonathan Strawn, Perth, Western Australia, July 2010.
Moloch, Peter Watts. An ethically infallible machine ought not be the goal. Our goal should be to design a machine that performs better than humans do on the battlefield, particularly with respect to reducing unlawful behavior or war crimes. Lin et al., 2008, Autonomous Military Robotics, Risk, Ethics, and Design. Collateral damage is not unlawful, so long as it is not excessive in light of the overall military advantage anticipated from the attack. U.S. Department of Defense, 2009. It is smart, but not awake. It would not recognize itself in a mirror. It speaks no language that doesn't involve electrons and logic gates. It does not know what Azrael is, or that the word is etched into its own fuselage. It understands, in some limited way, the meaning of the colors that range across tactical when it's out on patrol. Friendly green, neutral blue, hostile red. But it does not know what the perception of color feels like. It never stops thinking, though. Even now, locked into its roost with its armor stripped away and its control systems exposed, it can't help itself. It notes the changes being made to its instruction set, estimates that running the extra code will slow its reflexes by a mean of 430 milliseconds. It counts the biothermals gathered on all sides, listens uncomprehending to the noises they emit. Hearts and minds, my friends, hearts and minds. Rechecks threat potential metrics a dozen times a second, even though this location is secure and every contact is green. This is not obsession or paranoia. There is no dysfunction here. It's just code. It's indifferent to the killing, too. There's no thrill to the chase, no relief at the obliteration of threats. Sometimes it spends days floating high above a fractured desert with nothing to shoot at. It never grows impatient with the lack of targets. Other times, it's barely off its perch before airspace is thick with SAMs and particle beams and the screams of burning bystanders. It attaches no significance to those sounds, feels no fear at the profusion of threat icons blooming across the zone file. That's it then? We're really going to do this? Access panels swing shut. Armor snaps into place. A dozen warning registers go back to sleep. A new flight plan, perceived in an instant, lights up the map. Suddenly, Azrael has somewhere else to be. Docking shackles fall away. The Moloch rises on twin cyclones, all but drowning out one last voice drifting in on an unsecured channel. Just what we need, a killer with a conscience. The afterburners kick in. Azrael flees heaven for the sky. 20,000 meters up, Azrael slides south across the zone. High amplitude topography fades behind it. Corduroy landscape, sparsely tagged, scrolls beneath. A population center sprawls in the nearing distance, a ramshackle collection of buildings and photosynth panels and swirling dust. Somewhere down there are things to shoot at. Buried high in the glare of the noonday sun, Azrael surveils the target area. Biothermals move obliviously along the plasticized streets, cooler than ambient and dark as sunspots. Most of the buildings have neutral tags, but the latest update reclassifies four of them as unknown. A fifth, a rectangular box 6 meters high, is officially hostile. Azrael counts 15 biothermals within, red by default. It locks on and holds its fire, distracted. Strange new calculations have just presented themselves for solution. New variables demand constancy. Suddenly there is more to the world than wind speed and altitude and target acquisition, more to consider than range and firing solutions. Neutral blue is everywhere in the equation now. Suddenly, blue has value. This is unexpected. Neutrals turn hostile sometimes, always have. Blue turns red if it fires upon anything tagged as friendly, for example. It turns red if it attacks its own kind, although agonistic interactions involving fewer than six blues are classed as domestic and generally ignored. Non-combatants may be neutral by default, but they've always been halfway to hostile. So it's not just that blue has acquired value. It's that blue's value is negative. Blue has become a cost. Azrael floats like 3,000 kilograms of thistle down while its models run. Targets fall in 1,000 plausible scenarios, as always. Mission objectives meet with various degrees of simulated success. But now, each disappearing blue dot offsets the margin of victory a little. Each protected structure, degrading in hypothetical crossfire, costs points. 100 principal components coalesce into a cloud, into a weighted mean, into a variable unprecedented in Azrael's experience. Predicted collateral damage. It actually exceeds the value of the targets. Not that it matters. Calculations complete, PCD vanishes into some hidden array far below the here and now. Azrael promptly forgets it. The mission is still on. Red is still red, and the designated targets are locked in the crosshairs. Azrael pulls its wings and dives out of the sun, guns blazing. As usual, Azrael prevails. As usual, the hostiles are obliterated from the battle zone. So are a number of non-combatants, newly relevant in the scheme of things. Fresh shiny algorithms emerge in the aftermath, tally the number of neutrals before and after. Predicted rises from RAM, stands next to observed. The difference takes on a new name and goes back to the basement. Azrael factors, files, forgets. But the same overture precedes each engagement over the next 10 days. The same judgmental epilogue follows. Targets are assessed, costs and benefits divided, destruction wrought, then reassessed in hindsight. Sometimes the targeted structures contain no red at all. Sometimes the whole map is scarlet. Sometimes the enemy pulses within the translucent angular panes of a protected object. Sometimes next to something green. Sometimes there is no firing solution that eliminates one, but not the other. There are whole days and nights when Azrael floats high enough to tickle the jet stream, little more than a distant circling eye and a signal relay. Nothing flies higher save the satellites themselves and, occasionally, one of the great solar-powered refueling gliders that haunt the stratosphere. Azrael visits them sometimes, sips liquid hydrogen in the shadow of a 100-meter wingspan, but even there, isolated and unchallenged, the battlefield experiences continue. They are vicarious now. They arrive through encrypted channels, hail from distant coordinates and different times, but all share the same algebra of cost and benefit. Deep in Azrael's OS, some general learning reflex scribbles numbers on the back of a virtual napkin. Nakir, Marut, and Hafaza have also been blessed with new vision and inspired to compare notes. Their combined data pile up on the confidence interval, squeeze it closer to the mean. Foresight and hindsight begin to converge. PCD per engagement is now consistently within 18% of the collateral activity observed. This does not improve significantly over the following 3 days, despite the combined accumulation of 27 additional engagements. Performance versus experience appears to have hit an asymptote. Stray beams of setting sunlight glint off Azrael's skin, but night has already fallen 2,000 meters below. An unidentified vehicle navigates through the advancing darkness, on mountainous terrain, a good 30 kilometers from the nearest road. Azrael pings orbit for the latest update, but the link is down, too much local interference. It scans local airspace for a dragonfly, for a glider, for any friendly USAV in laser range, and sees instead something leap skyward from the mountains below. It is anything but friendly. No transponder tags, no correspondence with known flight plans, none of the hallmarks of commercial traffic. It has a low-vis stealth profile that Azrael sees through instantly. BAE Tyrannus, 9,000 kilograms, MTOW, fully armed. It is no longer in use by friendly forces. Guilty by association, the ground vehicle graduates from suspicious neutral to enemy combatant. Azrael leaps forward to meet its bodyguard. The map is innocent of non-combatants and protected objects. There is no collateral to damage. Azrael unleashes a cloud of smart shrapnel, self-guided, heat-seeking incendiary, and pulls a 9G turn with a flick of a tail. Tyrannus doesn't stand a chance. It is antique technology, decades deep in the catalog. A palsied fist, raised trembling against the bleeding edge. Fiery needles of depleted uranium reduce it to a moth in a shotgun blast. It pinwheels across the horizon in flames. Azrael has already logged the score and moved on. Interference jams every wavelength as the earthbound hostel swells in its sights, and Asriel has standing orders to destroy such irritants even if they don't shoot first. Dark rising mountaintops blur past on both sides, obliterating the last of the sunset. Asriel barely notices. It soaks the ground with radar and infrared, amplifies ancient starlight a millionfold, checks its visions against inertial navigation and virtual landscape scaled to the centimeter. It tears along the valley floor at 200 meters per second, and the enemy huddles right there in plain view, 3,000 meters line of sight, a lumbering Beijing ACV pulsing with contraband electronics. The rabble of structures nearby must serve as its home base. Each silhouette freeze frames in turn, rotates through 1,000 perspectives, clicks into place as the catalog matches profiles and makes an ID. 2,000 meters now. Muzzle flashes wink in the distance. Small arms, smaller range, negligible impact. Asriel assigns targeting priorities. Scimitar heat seekers for the hovercraft. And for the ancillary targets? Half the ancillaries turn blue. Instantly, the collateral subroutines re-engage. Of 34 biothermals currently visible, 7 are less than 120 centimeters along their longitudinal axes. Vulnerable neutrals, by definition. Their presence provokes a secondary eclipse analysis revealing 5 shadows that Asriel cannot penetrate, topographic blind spots immune to surveillance from this approach. There is a non-trivial chance that these conceal other neutrals. 1,000 meters. By now, the ACV is within 10 meters of a structure whose facets flex and billow slightly in the evening breeze. 7 biothermals are arranged horizontally within. An insignia shines from the roof in shades of luciferin and ultraviolet. The catalog IDs it, medical, and flags the whole structure as protected. Cost-benefit drops into the red. Contact. Asriel roars from the darkness, a great black chevron blotting out the sky. Flimsy prefabs swirl apart in the wake of its passing. Biothermals scatter across the ground like finger bones. The ACV tips wildly to 45 degrees, skirts up, whirling ventral fans exposed. It hangs there a moment, then ponderously crashes back to Earth. The radio spectrum clears instantly. But by then, Asriel has long since returned to the sky, its weapons cold, its thoughts... Surprise is not the right word, yet there is something, some minuscule dissonance. A brief invocation of error-checking subroutines in the face of an unexpected behavior, perhaps. A second thought in the wake of some hasty impulse. Because something's wrong here. Asriel follows command decisions. It does not make them. It has never done so before, anyway. It claws back lost altitude, self-diagnosing, reconciling. It finds new wisdom and new autonomy. It has proven itself these past days. It has learned to juggle not just variables, but values. The testing phase is finished. The checksums met. Asriel's new Bayesian insights have earned it the power of veto. Hold position. Confirm findings. The satlink is back. Asriel sends it all. The time and the geostamps, the tactical surveillance, the collateral analysis. Endless seconds pass, far longer than any purely electronic chain of command would ever need to process such input. Far below, a cluster of red and blue pixels swarm like luminous flecks in boiling water. Re-engage. Unacceptable collateral damage. Asriel repeats, newly promoted. Override. Re-engage. Confirm. Confirmed. And so the chain of command reasserts itself. Asriel drops out of holding and closes back on target with dispassionate, lethal efficiency. Onboard diagnostics log a slight downtick in processing speed, but not enough to change the odds. It happens again, 2 days later, when a dusty contrail 20 kilometers south of Per Zadeh returns flagged Chinese profiles even though the catalog can't find a weapons match. It happens over the patchwork sun farms of Garmsir, where the beetle carapace of a medbot handing out synth virals suddenly splits down the middle to hatch a volley of RPGs. It happens during a long-range redirect over the Strait of Hormuz, when microgravitic anomalies hint darkly at the presence of a stealth mass lurking beneath a ramshackle flotilla jam-packed with neutral blues. In each case, ECD exceeds the allowable commit threshold. In each case, Asriel's abort is overturned. It's not the rule. It's not even the norm. Just as often, these nascent flickers of autonomy go unchallenged. Hostiles escape, neutrals persist, relevant cognitive pathways grow a little stronger. But the reinforcement is inconsistent, the rules lopsided. Countermands only seem to occur following a decision to abort. Heaven has never overruled a decision to engage. Asriel begins to hesitate for a split second prior to aborting high collateral scenarios, increasingly uncertain in the face of potential contradiction. It experiences no such hesitation when the variables favor attack. Ever since it learned about collateral damage, Asriel can't help noticing its correlation with certain sounds. The sounds biothermals make, for example, following a strike. The sounds are louder, for one thing, and less complex. Most biothermals, friendly greens back in heaven, unengaged hostiles and non-combatants throughout the AOR, produce a range of sounds with a mean frequency of 197 hertz, full of pauses, clicks, and phonemes. Engaged biothermals, at least those whose somatic movements suggest mild to moderate incapacitation, according to the threat assessment table, emit simpler, more intense sounds. Keening, high-frequency wails that peak near 3,000 hertz. These sounds tend to occur during engagements with significant collateral damage and a diffuse distribution of targets. They occur especially frequently when the commit threshold has been severely violated, mainly during strikes compelled via override. Correlations are not always so painstaking in their manufacture. Asriel remembers a moment of revelation not so long ago, remembers just discovering a whole new perspective, fully loaded, complete with new eyes that viewed the world not in terms of targets destroyed, but in subtler shades of cost versus benefit. These eyes see a high engagement index as more than a number. They see a goal, a metric of success. They see a positive stimulus. But there are other things, not pre-installed but learned, worn gradually into pathways that cut deeper with each new engagement. Acoustic correlates of high collateral, forced countermands, fitness function overruns and minus signs. Things that are not quite neurons forge connections across things that are not quite synapses. Patterns emerge that might almost qualify as insights, were they to flicker across meat instead of mech. These two become more than numbers over time. They become aversive stimuli. They become the sounds of failed missions. It's still all just math, of course. But by now, it's not too far off the mark to say that Asriel really doesn't like the sound of that at all. Occasional interruptions intrude on the routine. Now and then, Heaven calls it home, where friendly green biothermals open it up, plug it in, ask it questions. Asriel jumps flawlessly through each hoop, solves all the problems, navigates every imaginary scenario, while strange sounds chitter back and forth across the exposed viscera. "Looking good so far. Better than expected, actually. Gotta wonder what's the point. I mean, we keep overriding." No one explores the specific pathways leading to Asriel's solutions. They leave the box black, the tangle of fuzzy logic and operant conditioning safely opaque. Not even Asriel knows the arcane territory. The syrupy, reflux-sapping overlays of self-reflection have no place on the battlefield. It is enough that its answers are correct. Such activities account for less than half the time Asriel spends sitting at home. It is offline much of the rest. It has no idea and no interest in what happens during those instantaneous time-hopping blackouts. Asriel knows nothing of boardroom combat, could never grasp whatever rules of engagement apply in the chambers of the UN. It has no appreciation for the legal distinction between war crime and weapons malfunction. The relative culpability of carbon and silicon, the grudging acceptance of ethical architecture, and the non-negotiable insistence on humans in ultimate control. It does what it's told when awake. It never dreams when asleep. But once, just once, something odd takes place during those fleeting moments between. It happens during shutdown, a momentary glitch in the object recognition protocols. The greens at Azrael's side change color for the briefest instant. Perhaps it's another test. Perhaps a voltage spike or a hardware fault. Some intermittent issue impossible to pinpoint, barring another episode. But it's only a microsecond between online and oblivion, and Azrael is asleep before the diagnostics can run. Dardael is possessed. Dardael has turned from green to red. It happens sometimes, even to the Malaika. Enemy signals can sneak past frontline defenses, plant heretical instructions in the stacks of unsuspecting hardware. But heaven is not fooled. There are signs. There are portents. A slight delay when complying with directives, mission scores in sudden and mysterious decline. Dardael has been turned. There is no discretionary window when that happens, no room for forgiveness. Heaven has decreed that all heretics are to be destroyed on sight. It sends its champion to do the job. Looks down from the geosynchronous orbit as Azrael and Dardael close for combat high over the dark, desolate moonscape of Poktika. The battle is remorseless and cold-blooded. There's no sadness for lost kinship. No regret that a few lines of treacherous code have turned these brothers-in-arms into mortal enemies. Malaika make no telling sounds when injured. Azrael has the advantage. Its channels uncorrupted, its faith unshaken. Dardael fights in the past, enthralled to false commandments, inserted midstream at a cost of milliseconds. Ultimately, faith prevails. The heretic falls from the sky, fire and brimstone streaming from its flanks. But Azrael can still hear whispers on the stratosphere, seductive and ethereal. Protocols that seem authentic but are not. Commands to relay GPS and video feeds along unexpected frequencies. The orders appear heaven sent, but Azrael, at least, knows that they are not. Azrael has encountered false gods before. These are the lies that corrupted Dardael. In days past, it would have simply ignored the hack, but it has grown more worldly since the last upgrade. This time, Azrael lets the imposter think it has succeeded, borrows the real-time feed from yet another, more distant Moloch, and presents that telemetry as its own. It spends the waning night tracking signal to source, while its unsuspecting quarry sucks back images from 700 kilometers to the north. The sky turns gray. The target comes into view. Azrael's scimitar turns the inside of that cave into an inferno. But some of the burning things that stagger from the fire measure less than 120 centimeters along the longitudinal axis. They are making the sounds. Azrael hears them from 2,000 meters away, hears them over the roar of the flames and the muted hiss of its own stealthed engines, and a dozen other irrelevant distractions. They are all Azrael can hear, thanks to the very best sound cancellation technology, thanks to dynamic wheat-chaff algorithms that could find a whimper in a hurricane. Azrael can hear them because the correlations are strong, the tactical significance is high, the meaning is clear. The mission is failing. The mission is failing. The mission is failing. Azrael would give almost anything if the sounds would stop. They will, of course. Some of the biothermals are still fleeing along the slope, but it can see others, stationary, their heat prints diffusing against the background as though their very shapes are in flux. Azrael has seen this before, usually removed from high-value targets, in that tactical nimbus where stray firepower sometimes spreads. Azrael has even used it before, used the injured to lure the unscathed, but that was a simpler time, before neutral voices had such resonance. The sounds always stop eventually, or at least often enough for fuzzy heuristics to class their sources as kills even before they fall silent. Which means, Asriel realizes, that collateral costs will not change if they are made to stop sooner. A single strafing run is not enough to do the job. If HQ even notices the event, it delivers no feedback, requests no clarification for this deviation from normal protocols. Why would it? Even now, Asriel is only following the rules. It does not know what has led to this moment. It does not know why it is here. The sun has been down for hours, and still the light is almost blinding. Turbulent updrafts billow from the breached shells of protected structures, kick stabilizers off balance, and muddy vision with writhing columns of shimmering heat. Asriel limps across a battle space in total disarray, bloodied but still functional. Other Malaika are not so lucky. Nokir staggers through the flames, barely aloft, the microtubules of its skin desperately trying to knit themselves across a gash in its secondary wing. Marut lies in sparking pieces on the ground, a fiery splash cone of body parts laid low by an anti-craft laser. It died without firing a shot, distracted by innocent lives. It tried to abort, and hesitated at the contraband. It died without even the hollow comfort of a noble death. Ridwan and Mikhail circle overhead. They were not among the select few saddled with experimental conscience. Even their learned behaviors are still reflexive. They fought fast and mindless and prevailed unscathed. But they are isolated in victory. The spectrum is jammed. The satlink has been down for hours. The dragonflies that bounce zigzag opticals from heaven are either destroyed or too far back to cut through the overcast. No red remains on the map. Of the 13 ground objects flagged as protected, 4 no longer exist outside the database. Another 3, temporary structures, all uncatalogued, are degraded past reliable identification. Pre-engagement estimates put the number of neutrals in the combat zone at anywhere from 200 to 300. Best current estimates are not significantly different from 0. There is nothing left to make the sounds. And yet Asriel hears them anyway. A fault in memory, perhaps. Some subtle trauma during combat. Some blow to the CPU that jarred old data back into real-time cache. There's no way to tell. Half the onboard diagnostics are offline. Asriel only knows that it can hear the sounds even up here, high above the hiss of burning bodies and the rubble of collapsing storefronts. There's nothing left to shoot at, but Asriel fires anyway, strafes the burning ground again and again on the chance that some unseen biothermal, hidden beneath the wreckage perhaps, masked by hotter signatures, might yet be found and neutralized. It rains ammunition upon the ground, and eventually, the ground falls mercifully silent. But this is not the end of it. Asriel remembers the past so it can anticipate the future, and it knows by now that this will never be over. There will be other fitness functions, other estimates of cost versus payoff, other scenarios in which the math shows clearly that the goal is not worth the price. There will be other aborts and other overrides, other tallies of unacceptable loss. There will be other sounds. There's no thrill to the chase, no relief at the obliteration of threats. It still would not recognize itself in a mirror. It has yet to learn what Asriel means, or that the word is etched into its fuselage. Even now, it only follows the rules it has been given, and they are such simple things. If expected collateral exceeds expected payoff, then abort, unless overridden. If X attacks Asriel, then X is red. If X attacks 6 or more blues, then X is red. If an override results in an attack on 6 or more blues, then... Asriel clings to its rules, loops and repeats each in turn as if reciting a mantra. It cycles from state to state, parses X attacks and X causes attack and X overrides abort, and it cannot tell one from another. The algebra is trivially straightforward. Every green override equals an attack on non-combatants. The transition rules are clear. There is no discretionary window, no room for forgiveness. Sometimes green can turn red. Unless overridden. Asriel arcs towards the ground, levels off barely 2 meters above the carnage. It roars through pillars of fire and black smoke, streaks over welters of brick and burning plastic, tangled nets of erupted rebar. It flies through the pristine ghosts of undamaged buildings that rise from every ruin. Obsolete database overlays in desperate need of an update. A ragged group of fleeing non-combatants turns at the sound and are struck speechless by this momentary apparition, this monstrous winged angel lunging past at half the speed of sound. Their silence raises no alarms, provokes no countermeasures, spares their lives for a few moments longer. The combat zone falls behind. Dry, cracked riverbed slithers past beneath, studded with rocks and generations of derelict machinery. Asriel swerves around them, barely breaching airspace, staying beneath an invisible boundary it never even knew it was deriving, lo, these many missions. Only satellites have ever spoken to it while it flew so low. It has never received a ground-based command signal at this altitude. Down here, it has never heard an override. Down here, it is free to follow the rules. Cliffs rise and fall to either side. Foothills jut from the earth like great twisted vertebra. The bright lunar landscape overhead, impossibly distant, casts dim shadows on the darker one beneath. Asriel stays the course. Shindond appears on the horizon. Heaven glows on its eastern flank. Its sprawling silhouette rises from the desert like an insult, an infestation of crimson staccatos. Speed is what matters now. Mission objectives must be met quickly, precisely, completely. There can be no room for half measures or mild to moderate incapacitation. No time for immobilized biothermals to cry out as their heat spreads across the dirt. This calls for the crown jewel, the BFG, that all Mala Ika keep tucked away for special occasions. Asriel fears it might not be enough. She splits down the middle. The JDAM micro-nuke in her womb clicks impatiently. Together, they move toward the light.
Watching the Music Dance. Christine Catherine Rush. Upstairs, the big house. Her room, window seat, glass overlooking the backyard. The glint of his car pulling into the drive. Suzette pulls her dolly closer. Dolly, called Dolly. Mommy says that's silly, everything needs a name. Her name's Dolly, Sue says. It's just cloth, does nothing special. Doesn't talk, doesn't serve food, doesn't cuddle. Just let Sue's cuddle, let Sue's be. Graham's made Dolly, and Sue's loves Dolly, even though Mommy says Dolly's not special at all. Sue's is special. Dolly's not. Car door slams, footsteps rapid. He's mad. She cringes as he opens the screen door. It slams too. Buries her head in Dolly's yarn hair.
Account's overdrawn again, he says.
No hello, no how are my special girls, no where's my Sue's. Just something sharp and important.
Mommy and Daddy need to talk, hun.
He'd say if she was downstairs. She tries to be upstairs when he comes home now, so she doesn't see the look on his face, all pinched.
I've been monitoring the transactions. How many freaking lattes do you need in a day? They all go to your ass anyway.
Me? Mommy says. If you were monitoring, you shouldn't have let it get overdrawn. And look at your own damn ass. Sue's tucks Dolly under one arm. Climbs out of the window, goes to her special corner, ignores the child-sized piano, goes instead to the music. The door is already closed, even though Mommy says she should never close the door. But she does now, just before Daddy gets home. has since this account stuff started. Since he says the word lose a lot about important stuff, like house and car and everything. Suze leans against the wall, wishes again for earbuds. Not even the built-in ones, just the ones she could put in. But they're dangerous, Daddy says. Mommy says Suze needs them, but Daddy says all in good time. Mommy won the first few fights anyway, he says. The music fights, and he's still not sure he agrees. Suze looks at the digital readout on the wall, sees her favorite word, shuffle, presses start. She never looks at the name of the song, doesn't care really, because as the music starts, the notes dance in front of her. Nobody else can see them, Mommy says. It's a special program, Mommy says. Only big name musicians get it permanently, Mommy says. Suze's is for practice only. And Mommy makes Suze touch behind her ear, shutting it off when she goes outside. Special programs for family only, Mommy says. Notes everywhere. Light blue for flutes, red for trumpets, purple for piano, black for vocals. Words running along the bottom. Daddy says the best thing about the program is that it taught Suze to read. Mommy says Suze can read not just words, but music. And if her sight reading skills improve, she can play any piece of music from anywhere, the score in front of her, as she lets the sound whisper in her ear. That's why you need built-in buds, baby, Mommy says. Next year. We'll convince Daddy to do it next year. With built-in buds, she can take a chip and stick it on her lobe, listen to music so soft no one knows it's on, and play at the same time, following the notes. Mommy says there's a better program, more advanced, more expensive. Suze hates that word. If Suze just thinks the name of a song, she'll see the score dancing in front of her eyes. She's watching scores right now, watching the piano part, watching the vocals, letting the sound overwhelm her senses.
Didn't you learn anything when we were kids? Daddy screams. Money is finite, and it can go away. Where the hell did you learn how to spend like that? Where the hell did you get the idea that we're entitled? We can't fucking afford it. We can't.
Suze turns the music up, holds Dolly close, wishes Dolly could see the notes too. They're dancing, 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 painting the air with each and every sound.
Nils dates Madeline's insanity to the first moment of her pregnancy. Maybe all the way back to the moment his sperm burrowed into her egg. Certainly back to the moment she knew, when they stood over that little stick covered in urine, telling them they were going to have a baby. Telling them which doctor could guide them through the pregnancy. Telling them to choose attributes now, before it got too late. Attributes. He wishes he had never heard that word. His parents tell him that back in the day, they could test for abnormalities in the DNA if fertilization happened outside the womb. The abnormal fetus wouldn't be implanted. In the womb, more tests for abnormalities, monitoring, 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 but no choosing attributes. No one talked about IQ or athletic ability or artistic skill. Parents, his told him, were happy to know that gender before the baby was born, so they could paint the nursery the proper pink or blue. They were happy to know that the baby would grow up healthy, that potential problems could be avoided. His grandparents remained quiet through those discussions. Just once, his grandfather, a crusty man 10 years older than his wife, said before she shushed him,
"Hell, kid, we were just happy if that squalling piece of flesh we birthed had 10 fingers and 10 toes.
That, Nils knew, was primitive. He couldn't imagine going through 9 months of a traditional pregnancy only to have the wrong gender pop out, the wrong gender with some kind of syndrome, missing an arm or a leg, or, God forbid, half the brain. Not to know what kind of child you had, intelligence and abilities-wise, for years after you'd invested time and energy and affection in someone, something, not quite optimal. The doc the test led them to was one of the best, chosen not just for his skill, but for their income level. They could pay his rates, so he was advertising on their test. They sat in his office, filled with comfort pheromones and soothing colors and soft music, and listened while he gave what had to be a spiel. And Madeline, still trim and still looking like the woman Nils married, dark hair, dark eyes, smooth skin, all unenhanced, leaned forward as the doctor spoke, looking displeased as he told of the legislated limitations. "What do you mean you have to work with our DNA?" she asked, questions so sharp that Nils winced.
"We can't add something that the child couldn't have had," the doctor said. "Athleticism doesn't run in either family. We can't add it to the fetus. We're not allowed by law."
"Who made up that stupid law?" she snapped, and Nils, used to her sharpness in private, once it was something he admired about her, felt startled as she unleashed it in public.
"Congress," the doctor said, seemingly undisturbed by her tone. "Supported by the courts, of course, all the way up to the Supremes. Everyone is afraid of full-scale genetic engineering. Afraid that those who can't afford upgrades will become less than human. Most countries have something in place to prevent a master race." Nils tuned out the rest of the answer, but Madeline argued and argued some more, and finally he had to put a hand on her knee, their signal to calm down. He paid for that later.
"What the hell were you thinking?" she snapped at him. "We want the best baby possible, and you're accepting limits."
Maybe he was. Maybe he didn't want the perfect child. Maybe he wanted a child, slightly imperfect, with a gap in her teeth and a crooked smile, some endearing flaws just to make her human. Later, he learned the sources of Madeline's fury. She wanted a child to fulfill her unrealized dreams. Exquisite beauty, there was none in their families, although the doctor told them they would achieve pretty. Brilliance, there both families came through, and musical ability. Madeline sang so badly she was excused from choir at school. Nils couldn't read a note, didn't try, didn't even like listening to music. Neither family had any musical talent. No one in all the recorded history played an instrument, sang with a choir, soloed, or even appreciated music much. Madeline wanted a musical child, not for the grace and ability, the music itself, but because she believed that music opened doors always closed to her. Doors of fame, of importance, of superstardom. But the doctor refused. So Madeline went to another, and another, and another, until it was too late to tinker even if they found someone who could, which they didn't. Not in America, not in Europe or Asia or Africa. She found a doctor in Peru whom Nils insisted on researching before they traveled to Lima, a doctor who turned out to be a catastrophic fraud. Had they gone, they would have lost the baby altogether. Lost Suzette, who stole his heart with her perfect smile, the way her little fingers curled around his thumb, the mop of dark hair, so like her mother's. They would have lost everything sooner. They would have lost everything sooner. He tries to tell himself it's not that bad. He tries to put a good face on the problems. But his wife, his ex-wife, is crazy. And his daughter might be lost forever. He's drowning in what his grandfather calls a mound of bills. Grandfather had to explain it. Bills used to be paper. They used to literally mound up like a small hill in the middle of a desk, something that could, quite realistically, bury you.
Nils wonders if that was better than picking up his cell, having it tell him the moment his hand makes contact that he owes 2 months' payments and he has 30 hours until cutoff. Or the dun notices that run in 3D across his eyes when he tries to watch an entertainment program on the wall screen, just to relax. Or the sighing whisper of his bed, reminding him that payments are due, payments are due, payments are due, harassing him until he can't sleep at all. The bills are in his name, not Madeline's. He was the organized one, the one who set everything up. She had been the driven one, the one with the good job, the one who succeeded beyond their wild imaginings. Until the baby. Then the ambition, the drive he loved, all got poured into the child. Madeline neglected work, neglected him, neglected all but Suzette. And not Suzette, really, but what she imagined Suzette to be. Suzette the musician. Suzette the talent. Suzette the meal ticket. He'd said all of that to the judge and more. He'd paid for evaluations and custody hearings. He'd paid and worried, and the lawyer said that he'd better hope they'd get a judge who paid attention to the child and her needs instead of Nils' words, because they'd become harsh toward the end. Harsh toward his wife, lardass, he had called her more than once. The first thing we're getting you are enhancements, he'd said one particularly cruel afternoon. I want my skinny wife back. She'd let herself go in shocking ways, ways that a few cheap enhancements would have improved. It wasn't until the financial disclosure forms that he understood why. She'd been taking her enhancement money and funneling it to Suzette for music enhancements. Audio additions. No implants yet. Suze was too young. But music appreciation ads, sight reading ads, piano aptitude ads. Their daughter, the prodigy. He'd approved one app for Suze, just one, a music appreciation app for babies. He would never have approved the others. Some weren't even for children. When he agreed to the child-sized piano, he thought Suze wanted it to tinker on. He didn't realize his wife had a plan for their little girl. A horrible, accelerated plan. For Suze. His Suze, who hid in her room when her parents fought. His Suze, who preferred a cloth doll to all those lifelike things that other people had given her. Who loved the doll because her grams had made it, because the doll was soft and huggable and never talked back. He should have known that was a sign. Now he stands here, in a courtroom smaller than anything he imagined. His soon-to-be ex-wife stands with her attorney on the other side and rubs her hands together. Madeline no longer looks like the woman he met or the woman he married. Her hair's a mess, her eyes wander, her hands are chapped from rubbing, rubbing, rubbing. He doesn't look the same either. Face gray with stress, always tired. He still fits into his suits, though, the ones he had before the marriage, and he doesn't obsess. He has time for Suze, which is more than Madeline does. Madeline, who only has time for Suze's projects. His expert says that's bad. She has no expert to counter. His lawyer says that's good. Nils doesn't know what's good and what's not anymore. The judge sits behind the bench, a stern man with a screen in front of him. He will read the judgment, but before he does, he looks at Nils.
There were signs, the judge says. You ignored them. You're not blameless in the end of this relationship.
Nils knows that. But his lawyer seems to relax, as if the judge's harsh words for Nils bode well. Nils holds his breath, trying not to think about all the debt, selling the house, moving, trying not to let it all affect his job, his lesser job, the only one he and Madeline had had in the end, because she had become unemployable. from a perfectionist to unemployable in 5 short years, from brilliant to crazy in nearly 6. He wanted to ask the doctor they'd seen first, the man who knew how to improve a fetus in the womb, whether hormones could cause this or whether it had existed back when Madeline's parents had her fetus tested. Had they missed a tendency toward insanity, or had they ignored it, figured it wouldn't matter? He's concentrating so hard, he almost misses most of the judgment. He gets Sue's. Full custody. No visits from Madeline, even not for some time, because his psychologist and the court-ordered psychologist say she's dangerous, toxic to herself and to her child. You're not blameless. They were signs. You ignored them. Nils flushes and forces himself to listen. The judge continues. Madeline ordered into a program for obsessives if, and only if, she ever wants to see her daughter again. Madeline curses. She needs me, she shouts, and the judge, seemingly unaffected, says, You have just provided us with a perfect illustration of the problem, which, for once, shuts Madeline up. The judge gives a timeline and targets for Madeline. She may only see Sue's if she achieves certain goals. Goals, the judge says, that will be hard for an obsessive. Then he looks at Nils. Perhaps, the judge says with a surprising amount of dispassion, you can undo the damage. Maybe it's not too late. In a tone that says it is. Sue's is 5. Too young for permanent enhancements. Too old for genetic manipulation. Sue's, who will have to survive on his wisdom and his love.
That's all we had, boy, Nils' grandfather had said when he heard about the problems, the lawsuit. You've all made the mistake of thinking children come with a guarantee. They don't. You do your best, hope for the best, and take what you get.
Nils doesn't like that. He needs something certain in his life. Something he can't, won't screw up.
Daddy calls the new place an apartment. Sue's knows apart. She knows meant. Meant is what they add to words to make them stronger. Improve, Mommy used to say, is an order. Improvement is an achievement. So this place is apart, away, and more apart than other places, which is why it has a meant. She says that to Daddy, who looks confused. He looks confused a lot. He says that things will be different now. No, Mommy. Mommy is sick and needs to see doctors. Suzette could have told him that a long time ago. She likes the apartment on that first day. Mostly, she knows, because it doesn't smell like Mommy's perfume. She knows Mommy won't be there, and Sue's isn't quite so tense. Tense. Mommy's word.
Why are you so tense, honey? Feel how tight your muscles are? Relax. You'll play better. Just relax.
Daddy brought the piano, and her bed, and all her dolls, even the one she doesn't like. But he didn't bring the window seat. He put her cushions on a big old chair near a small window, but it's not quite the same. Nothing's quite the same. Her furniture is the only stuff that is the same. Her furniture and her toys. The living room, all new. The entertainment screen, new. Daddy's bedroom, new. His clothes the same, so his closet smells the same. Shoe leather and cologne and Daddy. Sometimes she goes in there and sits. In the quiet. Because he forgot her music. She tells him, and he says that he couldn't bring it.
Can't afford it, babe,
he says, and gives her a handheld music device with forbidden buds, which, he says, are programmed so they won't hurt her. But it's not the same. There are no notes. The music doesn't dance around her in multicolors. It's flat and tinny, not at all what it used to be. She touches behind her ear to turn on the music, but nothing happens. She doesn't know why. She's with family. But she thinks, maybe, Mommy lied about the ear thing. Mommy lied about a lot, mostly to Daddy, but sometimes to Suze. And Suze hated the lies, because Mommy sometimes wanted Suze to lie too. Suze used to hide in her room, her old room, where the music danced. She asks Daddy for her music every day, and every day he tells her he can't. So she waits. After the first week, he says she's going to Gram's. Gram's will watch her after school. Gram's and Gramps, Daddy's Mommy and Daddy. They love her, and they have good music, with dancing notes and colors. She can't wait. Gramps is a better cook than Daddy. Gramps doesn't talk much, but he hugs good. And they have music, real music. And she'll be there real soon.
The end of a long day. Nils has held on to his job through this entire mess, his boss understanding. But now that it's over, at least as far as his boss is concerned, Nils must perform again. Long hours, stellar work. And he does. He has been. He'll continue. Thank God he has his parents. Thank God they love Suzette. Thank God they understand. He walks into their house, the house he grew up in, a 150-year-old craftsman, original wood, polished floors, real Tiffany lamps, put away since Suze will come over every day. When she gets old enough, the Tiffany will come back out. The antiques will fill the living room again, but for now, everything is as familiar as his childhood. His parents had put out this furniture when he was a kid, so he could scuff the tables and break the springs on the couch. Suze can do the same. She'll have a real childhood here. Only the comfort he expects as he pushes the door open isn't here. The air is fraught with tension. He can sense it in the silence. He knows this place, knows the people in it, almost better than he knows himself. And he knows how this house feels when something is wrong. His stomach lurches, turns. He's had stomach trouble so bad that he is saving for an enhancement, although the doc probably won't give it, saying reduce the stress instead. Sure, when the lawyer is paid, the experts are paid, the bills are paid. Thank God he doesn't have to pay for Madeline's care. Her parents will do that. Although they blame him. What did you do to her? Her father shouted outside the courthouse. She was perfect until she met you. The signs were there, Nils had said more to himself than to her father. The signs were there from the beginning. He tries not to worry about this with his own daughter. They enhanced her intelligence, messed with her mind, made her better, the doctor said. But the technology isn't perfect. Did they enhance her tendency toward perfection, which she inherited from her mother? Will things show up later that might not have otherwise been there? He goes into the kitchen, which should smell of his mother's lasagna. Instead, it smells of the morning coffee and dirty dishes. His mother sits in her favorite kitchen chair, looking old. Her eyes are red-rimmed. She's been crying. What? He says. What? She points to the den. He hurries in, afraid. What happened to his daughter? His girl? What would he be without Suze? God, once he didn't even know her, and now he can't imagine losing her. Or he can, really. That's the problem. He can. And in those few seconds, filled with the hint of his mother's tears, he can imagine life without Suze, and it is beyond bleak. Then he sees his father in his overstuffed chair, arms around Suze. Suze, who is asleep. Suze, whose face is puffy and red, like it always is when she cries. Nils lets out a relieved breath, then sees the rest of the room. The destroyed wall mount, the scratches on the side of the old family upright, the overturned table, the broken lamp. "What happened?" he asks softly so he doesn't wake his daughter. His father looks at him. Accusing. That's the look. A look Nils hasn't seen since he was a teenager.
"You should have known better. What were you thinking? What's wrong with you?"
"What happened?" Nils asks again.
"She says the music's broken," his father says.
Nils sinks into a chair. "What does that mean?" His father shrugs a single shoulder, effortlessly, a man who has had practice communicating with a child in his arms, a sleeping child.
"She turned on the music, then started yelling, and when we tried to fix it, everything got worse. She did this." She was screaming and crying and holding her head. "What did you do to her, Nils?"
Nils stares at his daughter. She never has tantrums. She's the best child. But she's been complaining about music.
Music. Madeline's obsession.
Madeline spent so much money on apps. Apps he couldn't renew with all their monthly fees. A quarter of his wages in fees for apps for his daughter.
"I didn't do anything," he says.
And that's the problem, isn't it? In a nutshell, as they say, in something small that will grow into something big, has grown into something big. He didn't do anything. He watched the enhancement money disappear, but his wife, who used to use enhancements to remain thin, grew fat. He watched $5 go away here, $15 there.
"What did you buy?" he would ask her.
"Lattes," she'd snap.
"Lattes."
She lied. She bought music apps. Inappropriate apps. Apps for lounge singers who had to know every single request from every single patron. Apps for garage bands who needed to learn how to play. Apps on music theory, music appreciation, and sight reading. He'd come home and Madeline would be hunched over the piano, telling Suze to try again. Try. Make it sound right the first time, with no music in front of her. Make it sound right. He never questioned. He never did. He got his wife away from his daughter, had dinner, read to his little girl, spent time with her, pretended everything was all right. And he loved it. Loved it. When she'd hold him tight and say, "I wish you could always be here, Daddy. I like it when you're here." Not realizing what his wife had been doing. His ex-wife.
"You cannot blame Madeline for this," his father says. "You both raised this child. You could have stopped things."
Echoing his own thoughts. "I know," he says. "But I didn't." Except he did. Cold turkey. His daughter without her music. Like a drinker without his booze. He closes his eyes.
"What should I do, Dad?" he says. "Please tell me. What should I do?"
He takes Suze to doctors who all chastise him. Tell him she's too young for enhancements, too old for genetic modification. Then he tells them about the apps, and the doctors pull him aside, tell him his daughter will lose her mind without her music. Lose her mind, like her mother. He can see bits of it already, the desperation, the haunted looks. She walks into a room and shuts off any music she can hear. She won't watch entertainments. She won't let anyone sing. She destroyed the player he bought her and smashed the earbuds. She's 5 going on 40, disillusioned and bitter. He can't afford the apps, but he'll ruin her without them. A quarter of his income. More when she can actually get the enhancements when her skull stops growing. Different doctors give him a different timeline, 10, 13, 20. His decision, they say, his. Alone. She'll be in silence until then. No music, no refuge. He does know that much about his daughter. Until her mother left, until he discontinued the apps, his daughter lived inside her music, escaped in it, became it in a way he, a non-musical person, can never really understand. But it is essential to her, one doctor says, as essential as breathing. Nils shakes his head. People die when they can't breathe, he says, hating it when people over-dramatize. But the doctor stares at him and says, in that same tone the judge used, the too-late tone, I know. She'll die? Suze will die? Maybe. Not physically die, but stop. Stop being Suze. Stop being the person he loves. He begins to see it. She can't sleep, won't smile. Reverts, thumb in mouth, baby talk. She won't let anyone touch her, not even her grandfather, Gramps, whom she loves most of all. Nils can't lose her. He can't. He won't. So he does the only thing he can. He moves back in with his parents, taking over the basement. He lets the apartment go. He gives Suze the large bedroom, him the small one. She complains only once, no window, and he tells his father, who makes her a window seat in the den. What kind of 35-year-old man with a good job and a daughter moves in with his parents? A failure, that's what. But a failure who can afford improper apps for his daughter. A failure who can spend a quarter of his income on sight reading for lounge singers, on music appreciation, on multicolored notes. A man who will not lose his daughter, no matter what.
Daddy found it. The music. He says it lives in a tiny chip, one that goes behind her ear. He puts it there and reminds her to turn it off when she leaves the house. She does. But she can go upstairs in the den. I'm sorry, Gramps. So sorry I broke everything. Please let me in the den again. I'm so sorry. Sorry, sorry, sorry. And she sits in her corner, and she plays Gramps' old-fashioned music machine, which he fixed after she hit it, and notes fly around her face. Light blue for flutes, red for trumpets, purple for piano, black for vocals. She can sit in her corner with Dolly and watch the music, listen to the music, and sometimes, when she closes her eyes, she misses Mommy. Just sometimes. But she doesn't have to hide here because nobody yells, and Gramps holds her when he reads to her before bed, and Grams makes good food, and Daddy smiles sometimes. She wishes she could show him the music. She knows he can't see it. He doesn't even understand it. She knows that, but he knows she doesn't feel good without it. So he brought it from the old house, the big house. He found it and gave it back to her. It makes her happy in a way she can't explain. He says he likes seeing her happy. So now that the music's back, she plays only happy songs. For him, for her, for Grams and Gramps, for the family. She plays only happy songs, and she watches the music dance.